This is a very far out story. There were a group of people who, I have a friend, his name is Larry Brilliant. And Larry is a doctor. He used to be known as Dr. America as part of the Hog Farm, which was a hippie commune in Berkeley. It was run by a fellow named Wavy Gravy, who was a clown, and Wavy works with children in leukemia wards as a clown. And among other things, he also MCs and stuff. And those of you that saw the movie Woodstock remember Wavy offering everybody breakfast in bed for 500,000 people. Because he gives away food. They bring the Hog Farm bus and feed people. Very beautiful man. Well, Larry was part of that, and he was a hippie doctor. And his wife went to India and met my guru, Neem Karoli Baba, and she brought Larry to him. And when Larry met my guru said to Larry, very shortly after meeting him, "UNO doctor." What Larry heard that was saying, "You are no doctor," which is what his mother had been saying to him for years because he wasn't earning a living, right? But the guru kept repeating, "UNO doctor, UNO doctor," till finally it sunk into Larry's mind that what he was saying is, "You are United Nations Organization doctor, UNO doctor." And there was a UNO thing, UN World Health Organization project to eradicate smallpox that was going on in India. So Larry went down, the bus trip from the mountains down to Delhi, and he went in with his long hair and his beard, and they said, "We don't want hippie doctors, thank you very much." And he was shown the door, he came back to the guru said, "UNO doctor, go." He went back, they said, "We don't want you," he came back, this is a long bus trip, and he just kept doing it, and it was like 7, 8, 9 times. Finally, he went into the United Nations, he said, "Look, if you got any job at all, I mean, I gotta get this guy off my back, I'll take any job you got." They said, "Well, you don't have a job as a doctor, but you could be an administrative assistant." He said, "Fine." So he joined the club of a group of people who were getting rid of smallpox. And I'm sure you know by now that smallpox is the one disease, human disease, that has been completely eradicated from the face of the earth at this point. There is not another case in the world. You don't have to have vaccinations, you don't have to have vaccination certificates, because it's gone. It's a very extraordinary phenomenon that humanity could band together from Russia, from the United States, from Czechoslovakia, from everywhere, and do it together and get rid of something completely. Well, the group that did this in Southeast Asia, particularly, where the last case, I mean, it's very exciting stuff. You've got maps with pins of each case, and you go with vaccination needles in jeeps and boats, and you raid villages, and oh, it's very exciting. It's like a war, you know. They got so juiced up that when it was over, they all got depressed. You can imagine, I mean, how much their identity was caught in that. And they didn't know what to do next. Well, one of the gals who was Larry's boss was this extraordinary lady. Her name was Nicole Grasset. She was a Swiss doctor. She's a dynamo. And she's a very takes on projects. And so she was with Sir John Wilson, who is a blind man who's head of the World Blindness Organization. And he said to her, "Nicole, you've taken on smallpox and beat it. Why don't you take on blindness?" Because it turns out that 80% of the blindness in the world is preventable or curable. It's extraordinary. So she said, "Okay." Larry, wanting to band with her and get her energy together, decided he'd start a foundation and get all of his buddies together. So he drew his buddies from all the different parts of his life. Now, he was now a professor at the University of Michigan in public health. He had been working with the World Health Organization. He was part of the Hog Farm. He was my guru, a devotee of my guru. So out of all those places, he drew these people together, and we met in a snowbound weekend in Michigan for the first meeting, and I can't tell you how bizarre it was. Because the organization he called it SEVA, which meant at that time Society for Epidemiological Voluntary Assistance. Only he knew that it also was the Sanskrit word for service. So there was a doctor in a three-piece suit with a dispatch case who had come there for a meeting of the Society for Epidemiological Voluntary Assistance, and he had come from Washington. And he came into the morning meeting, the first session, he set his briefcase down and he sat there, and suddenly in walked Wavy Gravy, who sat down next to him with a beanie on his head with a propeller on the top of it. The look of that doctor, I will never forget. I mean, it was like, there's some error here, you know. I'm not supposed to be in this place where this guy is, you know. And it took us about 3 days to figure out that behind all of our facades, we all really got off on service, and that's why Larry drew us together. And we realized that we had an extraordinary mix. I'll just give you the biography of one of the members of the board to give you a feeling for it. A man named Michael Jeffrey. I first met Michael when he had been in an automobile accident in Boston. He was a young lawyer, just passed the bar. He wasn't enjoying law. We met at his hospital bedside, and he was pretty broken up, and he said that he had read Be Here Now and so on, and we talked about it, and he decided to go to India. He went to India, and he went to the temple where my guru, Neem Karoli Baba, was, and he met Maharaji, and he ended up staying there. I mean, some of us stayed a few months, some of us stayed a year. He stayed years. And he took the most menial jobs. He was the guy that was washing the pots in the back room. Now, of all your memories of the hippie 60s and 70s, what's your worst dream? Somebody trained as a lawyer from a respectable family. See, he blows it. He ends up washing pots in a Hindu temple in India. You know, and he's just there with his long beard and he's washing the pots and you think, oh, it's gone to waste. Oh, this poor slob. Nice guy, very sweet, but gee whiz, is this really, you know? My guru left his body, Michael continued to wash pots. He washed pots for all the people left in the temple. Finally, after years of figuring out how to get his visa extended, he couldn't do it once, and the Indian government threw him out. So he came back to America. He had no raison d'etre anymore. He was confused. He sat in his confusion for a while. He decided to take another job, and he took a job as a public defender for the Eskimos in Barrow, Alaska. He's a lawyer, after all. And in order to be part of that, he learned Eskimo dances, he learned the Eskimo culture, he was now fishing for whales, he was taking on the oil companies, he was becoming an Eskimo like he'd become a Hindu. All I can tell you is 2 years ago, the governor of Alaska appointed Michael at 36 years old, the youngest Superior Court judge of Alaska. Okay? Isn't that a far out story? Okay. And he is an extraordinarily compassionate judge who's dealing with rape and murder and all the things, but dealing with it with the guidance of the guru about how do you bring compassion and love and yet be firm and do the whole thing and do the job impeccably. And that's the kind of board it is. So we took on blindness and we decided to take on, and to me that was a light thing. I didn't know what it meant. I'm not an ophthalmologist. I don't know. It was just a nice kind of game to play. We took on Nepal because Nepal is a very poor country and Nepal has a very high incidence of blindness. It's hard to understand what the situation is. The population in Nepal, the population in the United States is 16 times the population of Nepal. And there are in Nepal 15 ophthalmologists and there are in the United States 16,000. And a survey showed us that most of the blindness because of ultraviolet light is due to cataract. Cataract is an opaqueness of the lens, and it can be taken care of, in most cases, by an operation that in a mobile eye hospital takes 10 minutes and costs $15. Okay? Now, if you want to close your eyes for 1 minute, now imagine that you're not going to see again. And you're going to have to get up and go home and think of all the obstacles you're going to have. Think of all the help you're going to have. And as you get retrained, keep your eyes closed. As you get retrained, you'll have a dog or you'll have Braille and you'll have all these help systems to help you and special financial aid, all kinds of things the society will provide for you to help you out at this point. But now imagine you're living in a third world country where there aren't any of those support systems and the labor force is so close to survival that once you are blind, you are out of the labor force and the expected life duration for you is 3.5 years. But if you live onward because your family takes care of you in this hilly region, you may live until you die and you will never have your sight back because there is no 10 minutes and there is no $15. Okay, that's the emotional part of the thing. Now you can open your eyes. So we figured, well, we'll go into Nepal. Nepal has 300,000 people just like that. And we'll just get ophthalmologists from India, Pakistan, all these places, build eye hospitals, eye camps, do all this, and just get it moving. Well, what I started to learn was this was a big game. This wasn't little. In fact, thus far, we're 6 years into it, there are more people going blind every year in Nepal than we're yet getting ahead of. We're still behind. We're losing ground. And I saw that my 60s mentality was the mentality of kind of hit and run. You come in with a nice idea for a project, if everybody buys it, fine. If not, well, you go do something else. I hadn't ever learned to stay with something, to persist, to make a long-range plan, to make a commitment. This was a whole new experiment for me. A few years ago, Larry said, you know, the problem is that our overhead for our office and fundraising is eating up so much of our funds. You know, you watch, if you're a giver to charities, you watch what percentage is used for overhead, and in the big charities, it's a large percentage for overhead. He said, I think we should have an endowment to cut that out. Everybody said, great. He said, I'll take it on. So this is about 3 years ago, I guess, 4 years ago. So we went to granting agencies, and they said, no, we're not interested. So he decided he had an idea, he'd start a business. He started a business. Now I can tell you that business, which is the Netty Corporation, the stock of the Netty Corporation has now endowed the Saver Foundation with a $2 million endowment. This took 3 years. So that 100% of the overhead and fundraising is paid by the endowment, so every penny that's given goes directly into service. Every penny, 100%. When you give money, it goes directly into the field. The company he started was a software computer company. It's on the Vancouver Exchange, by the way. What it does is it sets up conferencing through computers so that you can carry on decision-making and businesses and stuff. The first beta test site for it was the Saver Foundation. So I do my work as chairman of the board in my bedroom on a computer. I mean, if you think old dogs can't learn new tricks, it's incredible. And I talk to Mike Jeffrey in Barrow, Alaska, and Ned Willard, WHO in Switzerland, and Steve Jones down at CDC in Atlanta, and on, Wavy in California, and on, and it's all done. We make decisions, we have votes, we do all this discussion, we have humor, we tell dirty jokes, we do it all on this computer. It's extraordinary. It's the latest dance. What we found, like our board meetings, where there's 16 of us on the board, our board meetings are really fierce. They are like encounter groups. They are knock-down, drag-out groups because what we're demanding is that the means and the ends be of the same stuff. Some of us came in, like Nicole, they were focused on the end. Let's get rid of blindness. And I come in saying, how we get rid of blindness is as important as that we get rid of blindness. And she says, I'm not interested in how we get rid of it, just get rid of it. And we meet like this. because we're coming from different kinds of service backgrounds. And we struggle and work with this and fight it out and argue it. And the growth in all of us is incredible. And it's hard. It's not easy. And what we began to see was the dynamics of a group trying to do service together at a conscious level. Now, there are many crises that come up where a group gets together to do an action, and they'll do it for all different motives, and you say, let's just get it done. I mean, if there are homeless people on the street, let's get them so they don't freeze to death. Let's do something now. And you don't say, well, if you're feeling too angry, don't do it. You say, do it. Let's get it done. But when you're in a long-term project, you've got to understand that how you serve has a lot to do with what level of suffering you will relieve. Because you find out it's not just that you give somebody food, it's how you give them food. Whether you make them feel less by the way you gave them food or more. Do you see them as a fellow soul so that the giving and the receiving is nothing? Did you end up graced by their accepting the food? Or do you think you did something for somebody? These are all levels of consciousness of service. So what we're doing now is we're trying to just support the compassionate heart in the society. And we're probably going to set up, we're starting to set up local groups in every city of people who would like to get the same juice we get out of service, SEVA groups. And they may not have anything to do with SEVA. They may set up and decide to work for Oxfam or for the homeless or for something else. It's just a group that comes together. Maybe they're all serving already. Maybe they're taking care of their children or nursing, and they come together only in order to reinforce their appreciation that you can grow through service. You don't have to burn out through service. Paul Gorman and I did a book called How Can I Help, which is really approaching these topics. That's what we're trying to do in this book. Deal with the way in which you can help that you grow towards freedom, that you look directly at suffering, because if you think your happiness in this society comes from turning your eyes away from people that are suffering, believe me, your happiness is riddled with fear. There was a moment, I've told this story, of standing in Marin County at the beach naked with a frisbee. I told it last time I was in this hall. Now, you may not want to visualize that. That's all right if you don't want to. I was there with a frisbee, and the question was, as I stood there about ready to throw the frisbee, into my mind came the image of Gandhi's tomb, and over Gandhi's tomb is written, think of the poorest person you've ever seen and ask whether your next act will be of any use to that person. Do you throw the frisbee or don't you? That's our question for ourselves, really. See, we have, each of us has a unique dharma or a unique path or a unique way through. The game isn't that all of us become alike. Each of us is hearing a different message of what our unique path is in our inner hearts, and it feels right on. And for you to deny the beauty in order to deal with the humiliated, or deny the humiliated in order to deal with the beauty, you're all of those things. You've got to listen to all those messages. You've got to enjoy the joy of the good fortune you have in life. To be affluent, to be in this society, to have these kinds of freedom that you have. And at the same moment, you've got to keep the heart, the compassionate heart open. It's that balancing that we're playing with. Yes, I threw the frisbee. And I continue to throw the frisbee. To me, life is joy. And the joy can include the service. Instead of the joy or the service. It's the joy through the service. It's all of it. All of it. The theme of this was really a quote from Saraha. I'm nearly done now. She says, he who clings to the void and neglects compassion does not reach the highest stage. But he who practices only compassion does not gain release from the toils of existence. He or she, however, who is strong in practice of both, remains neither in samsara or nirvana, remains neither in form nor formless. There is nowhere to stand. Yes, we are compassionate, but don't be busy being compassionate. Yes, it is all a dream and we are empty, but don't be busy being empty. You and I will find as we go on this journey that we are less and less definable. I have no idea who I am or what I'm doing here or what I'm supposed to do. Oh, I can give you any number of scenarios, but they're all just relatively real. There are other levels and other levels and other levels of what you and I are doing in this hall tonight. And finally, you don't even care. I mean, I don't even care what I'll do when I grow up. Because it's just going to be more of this and more of this and more of this, and this moment is enough. This is what this is about. And if there's suffering, if there, whatever there is at this moment, that too. If you're tired of sitting at this moment, that too. It's okay. That too. Questions? Sir? How did I find my guru when I went to India? See, this is another generation now. What do I do now? There's a book called Be Here Now. That after all these years is still selling, and it describes in vivid detail how I did that. So I'll pass it up tonight because 90% of these people have heard it ad nauseum, the reason. All I know, it was grace. I didn't find him, he found me. That sounds arrogant, but I mean, he brought me to him. I feel that, I feel his grace, incredible grace. I wasn't even expecting to meet anybody like that. Have I any advice for the Bhagwan of Oregon? Late of Oregon. I've never met him, and I find it very painful to watch the whole drama unfold, because I think that each time a spiritual statement gets fraught with paranoia and with anger and with divisiveness and all that, it really hurts all of us. Just hurts all of us. It hurts all of our faith. And I think that Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh has said some beautiful things and things that have offended me. He said he has many powers, obviously. He has a lot of siddhis. And I think that many people that come over from the East often are very vulnerable to our value systems. And it's easy to get holy in certain conditions and hard to keep it. It's hard to keep your high in New York City, you know, because there's a lot of desire stuff around. And I think that we're just realizing that you don't end up becoming, as I've said before, a connoisseur of clay feet. You take what you can take from each teacher, and then if they end up with their impurities, that's their problem. You don't spend your time being bitter or judging or anything. There's no sense in doing that at all. And don't demand that everybody be perfect. Just take what you can. There were some beautiful teachings that came out of Rajneesh and may come again. There's also his life is a teaching. Each of us in our hearts will know what message we get from it. I think the game is much more subtle than the one we've been thinking it is, where some perfectly wise person says just the way it is all the time. I think the whole thing is the teaching. And I've been getting a tremendous teaching out of Rajneesh. You know, each Rolls Royce, I just want one of them. I mean, I got to get in my Volvo every day and think of him with 90 Rolls Royces. And, oh, God. Why aren't I pure enough to have 90 Rolls Royces? What are my thoughts about Adam? Or also known as XTC. It's a chemical. that is been used very widely. It's just been outlawed by the DEA. It's been used widely in therapy and in relationships, and those of you that have used it know that it is quite extraordinary in the way in which it allows people to see through the veils and to see the preciousness of their partner. And it takes a lot of relationships that are very locked in habitual closeness to each other and opens them up again. And I'm sorry it's been outlawed, I really am, because I think it has been useful. But I will say, and I'm really, certainly, I honor my drug experiences, and I've taken Adam many times and found it very beautiful. At the same moment, it's just beginning to dawn on me that I am constantly grabbing at a drug in order to make this moment different. And it's just getting to the point now where I'm ready to say that my liberation's going to be in this moment as it is. And I'm not quite trying to keep remolding it all the time. And I saw an interesting thing. I saw that this summer in meditation, that with drugs, there was a way in which the drug was constantly reinforcing a feeling that I wasn't enough the way I am. But me plus the drug would be something else. And that I needed it to break through places in myself. And then I met my guru, and I felt that I wasn't enough, but me plus my guru was enough. And that in a way, I was totally dependent on his grace, or I was totally dependent on the drugs. And when I was meditating, and always when they would take things, like in the Buddhist litany of the Eightfold Noble Path, there's a thing called right effort, and I always protested about that. And I always protested about the idea that I had any personal responsibility. I always say, I remember with Trungpa Rinpoche once, when he said, Ram Dass, we have to accept responsibility. I said, what responsibility? God has all the responsibility. I don't have any. Not my, but thy will, O Lord. And he said, you're copping out. And this summer when I was meditating, I'll tell you the story because it's interesting. I snuck in, secretly, a picture of my guru. See, that's a no-no in a Buddhist meditation center. You're supposed to just follow your breath. And I had it in my room, and every day I would allow myself a fix, you know. I'd look at him and say, I love you so much, and how do you think we can get through this together? And what happened was after about 2 weeks of meditation, this is a bizarre story. Suddenly, one morning I woke up and I was starting to follow my breath rising and falling, and into my mind came the chant, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Now I sang that chant from 1967, well, continuously for 10, 15 years. It's a method. And now, I couldn't stop the chant. And all the cows and the cars and everything all came out as Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. Everything sounded like the chant, and I kept thinking, I'll follow my breath, rising, falling, and the Shri Ram, Jai, rising, Shri Ram, Jai, and it wouldn't stop. And I started to climb the walls. And I thought, well, at least, the thing that's the major obstacle to this method is another holy method. I mean, that's not bad. I mean, I could be full with lust, but instead I'm just filled with holy songs. I'm just caught between two methods. For 2 weeks, this went on. Finally, I copped to it, and I went to my teacher, and I said, I've got this problem. My mind keeps creating this stuff. I know it's in my mind. I can't get rid of it. I'm trying not to get rid of it, but to live with it. I'm doing everything you tell me to do. What do I do? He says, oh, you must have studied in India. I said, yes. He said, were you a bhakti? I said, yes. And he sort of laughed. He says, well, he said, take refuge in the Buddha and you'll get rid of it. See? And I thought, my God, I'm going to use the Buddha to get rid of Ram. I mean, Ram is God and the Buddha, somehow, this is insane, you know. So I went back to my abode and I thought, well, look, it's fair. You do one method at a time. How many methods are you going to do at once? And if each method leads to truth, I shouldn't need to hold on to one method. Any method will bring me to the same place. So I took my guru's picture and I said, well, Maharaji, for 18 years, I haven't eaten a piece of food without offering it to you. I've just been thinking about you. You've been my method. I'm putting you away because you're truth and this method will bring me to truth and then I'll know you in a new way. Well, I put him away, and when I came to eating, I'd say, may this food bring me strength in order to pursue truth. See, instead of I offer it to, you know. I stopped offering him. He could starve to death. It didn't matter to me. I was going to do this thing. This coldness crept over me. I mean, it was very strange, and I just kept doing it, very cool. And the meditation went on. And immediately that I did that, put the picture away, the chant stopped, by the way. Far out, right? Now, I came back from the meditation, came back to the country, and my whole relation to my guru was changed. It wasn't this kind of slushy, devotional, you know, you there, I'm there, hi, you know, it wasn't the picture guy anymore. It was much more like a, oh, that kind of thing. It was like being with a rock or a very solid thing. And I started to wonder where that bhakti went, where that kind of really soft emotional place went, because I saw other bhakti people and I was kind of jealous of them. Sorry for this long story, but it's... Now, here's really where it got really hot. We had the first operation for my stepmother, and then there was a spot in her liver, and we weren't sure what that represented, because the first thing had been in her thigh and whether it had metastasized through her liver, in which case it would be systemic. So they did a needle biopsy. And then they were gonna call us on Tuesday, and she and I are doing this whole thing together. I mean, we visit the doctor together, we hang in together, we hold each other, we become very close through. We've known each other now in a way we never knew each other before she got sick. I mean, it's just incredible, the love between us. And she's an incredibly great woman. So the telephone call came on Tuesday noon, and I was in my room, and I happened to be on the floor reading and sitting there, and I looked up, and there was a picture of Maharaji on the wall. And here I've written a book called Miracle of Love, which some of you know, which is about 1,000 stories about Maharaji, many of which are miracle stories, in which he heals the blind and cures the lame and does all that stuff. See, so I look at the picture and the phone rings and the nurse says, just a minute for doctor. And I say to Maharaji, look, I'm not going to ask you for anything because you know it's got to be the way it's got to be and I know that too. So I can't really ask for anything in my prayers. But if it doesn't make any difference to you and you can, you know, a little something, I wouldn't mind, you know, if suddenly they say, oh, you know. The doctor comes on the phone and he says, Mrs. Alpert, I'm terribly sorry to have to tell you that it has metastasized to your liver. It's the worst kind of cell, very fast growing, and if we don't have it out right away, you'll be dead within a month. And I felt my heart grab like that. And I looked at the picture and I found myself involuntarily saying, you son of a bitch. And it absolutely blew my mind. And the next thought was, but we're still here, aren't we? And I realized at that moment that I had met him as Shiva. I had met him in the next level of our being together. That up until then, it had been relatively soft the way I knew the spirit. And now I was meeting that part that was involved with chaos and destruction and all of that. And I felt closer. But the closeness wasn't this kind of lush, soft closeness. It was just the closeness of, yeah, we're both here. And what I feel now is, in completion of that question, is that I am accepting the fact that I have responsibility and that I am working on myself. And I'm not asking him. I am living in grace with all of it, all of its grace, all of its grace. But it's not mushy anymore. It's very hard and clear and harsh. and soft. Well, the answer is there's no reason to do anything, but what are you going to do? So you can't not do something. And what you end up doing is wanting to keep opening yourself to be more an instrument of the harmony or the way of things. And you're constantly listening to hear, you're constantly doing it automatically, listening to hear how you fit into the play of it all. What part you play. And the more conscious you become and the more that compassionate heart opens, the more you are an instrument of the relief of suffering just by your being. The more you just keep creating an environment for other people to awaken if they want to awaken. You don't lay a trip, you don't force anybody, because there's nothing to do. You just are the statement of that compassionate consciousness. It's very far out. There's very little to do. So you can do it full time. Let us just end now, before you go, let us end with Jubilate, because it's just so nice. Now, this is a 6-part round, and you've got to be good or you'll screw up completely, all right? So, I got to knock you into shape very quickly. Jubilate Deo, Jubilate Deo, Alleluia. Alleluia. Again. Jubilate Deo, Jubilate Deo. Alleluia. Alleluia. Okay, now it's going to be crisper and cleaner, right? And sharper and a little faster, like we're awake. Jubilate Deo, Jubilate Deo, Alleluia, Alleluia. Once more without me.
Thanks for tuning into this program from Better Listen. Please visit betterlisten.com for more information about this program and the opportunity to share comments and feedback with others.